ACLU or National Immigration Law Center, choose a charity. One of our brothers recently said, make social justice a line item in your budget. And just do that regularly. As a person of faith, I know that I won't take any money that I have with me when I pass. And I don't know when I'll pass. I could pass when I leave here on my way to the airport. I could pass 40 years from now. My money won't come with me, but what I do with my money in this life is something that will follow me. If I believe in an afterlife, it will be a good deed. If I don't believe in an afterlife, it's still a legacy that I build here. So that's the second thing. And then the third, arguably, is to put your body on the line. Now that for me means going to protests. Stopping when I see the police pull over someone and saying, I'm going to park legally, keep my distance, and videotape this. Because should that police officer kill that person and I walked away from it, I don't know that I could live with myself. Sign up for ICE rapid response deployment. There's a number of groups, including in the East Bay, that will do that. They'll send out a text message that says, hey, there's an ICE raid happening. We need civilians to make sure that everything goes okay. When we were organizing for the Kavanaugh protests, I had the opportunity to be there on the first day of the Kavanaugh hearings in early September. Our sisters from the Women's March said, you are going to be uncomfortable tomorrow. Lean into that. And so when we get to the question of putting your body on the line, I'm not saying put yourself in danger. I'm saying lean into some of the discomfort. Is that this is supposed to be hard work. No matter which tradition you follow, from a faith perspective or even a civil rights and human rights perspective, the people who made lasting change were very uncomfortable. And so the third thing around putting your body on the line is to get uncomfortable.
Another question, are there steps that can be taken, that you think that can be taken toward eliminating racism within the realities of our capitalist system? And do you think racism exists in other economic systems?
So, generally speaking about racism, I would argue that it's a long, hard fight. Some people in the Muslim tradition have explained the falling of Satan at the beginning of time as a form of racism. They say that when he said, I will not bow, God creates Adam, God instructs Satan and the other beings to bow to Adam. And Satan says, I'm better than him. And so when I think of racism, I think of it as something that comes in at the beginning of time. This idea of I'm better than so-and-so because of my skin color, because of where I was born, because of my language. And I worry that that kind of elitism isn't, like once, if we can conquer it on race, we see it in culture. One of the things that I was really surprised to learn about Israeli Jews when we visited Palestine was the racism that exists between, or the divide that exists between Ashkenazi and Mizrahi Jews. I had no idea. And the way we learned about it was that when Ashkenazi Jews post-World War II were struggling to conceive, there was a crisis of kidnapping Mizrahi Jewish kids and bringing them into the Ashkenazi families. And I'm careful about how I speak about this because it's not my culture or my background. This is what we were told when we were visiting. And everyone thinking, well, they just fold in, like they just blend in, and they said, yes. They think that they're better than them, so they take the kids, but in the end, the kids are the kids, and so it's okay. So I don't have the solution to how we fight racism, except to say that I think it extends past faith, culture, class, or even economic systems. What we have to remind ourselves often, what I remind myself often, anytime I see someone struggling, is not that I am better than them, right? It's to say, like, I haven't been tested in that way. And I remember the story of Satan refusing to bow, and I think he thought he was better, and that was his downfall. Around whether or not racism can exist in other economic systems, I don't doubt that it can, that wherever there are opportunities for power grabs, that human nature needs to be tamed, that we have to be conscious of building community. I would not take for granted that someone who is a different color than me, darker or lighter, would fare the same in a different economic system. And so, again, thinking about racism being bigger than time, I think is something that we're going to have to be constantly vigilant of, but also one where I would challenge us to look at how we can combat racism in our own communities. That I am better positioned to combat anti-Black racism in the Pakistani immigrant community than a Black person would, because those things don't get said around my Black friends. Those communities don't invite those Black friends in, and so I have a responsibility to make sure that I'm speaking out against it. I would say that to my white allies, to say, there are people who will say Islamophobic things around you who would never dare say them around me. Maybe because I wouldn't be there to begin with, but maybe because they're polite. And so what can we do in our own communities to say, hey, this is not okay? The hardest question I get from young people sometimes is, what do I do about my family member who's racist? And my response is always, don't end the relationship. Be very careful not to end the relationship, because you might be the person who eventually changes that person.
Thank you.
Okay, we have a couple of questions about reasons for optimism. Can you tell us of something in the current?
Okay. It's hard. It's so hard to be optimistic amid all of this, but they say that in community organizing, one of the hardest things that we have to do is to find the wins. Because if it's bad news, bad news, bad news, well, my therapy bill is really high. But also, like, why do I keep showing up to hang out with all of you? I would say that one of the things that has given me an incredible boost of optimism in the past few months has been that we are sending two Muslim women to Congress come January. And they're not the only progressive candidates. I mean, there are a lot of young women of color who are going or are on their way to go to elected office come November and then come January. But the two women going to Congress in particular, one of them is Rashida Tlaib. She's a Palestinian-American woman from Michigan, I think the oldest of six children. She's going to Congress. So often what I think about when I think about the Palestinian crisis today, the theft of Palestinian land and the ongoing assault on the Palestinian people, is that a lot of what my community does is we send relief money to Palestine. We send food money, we send electricity money, we send college tuition money, we send relief money to Palestine. But the problem is right here in America. And one of the hardest things that we had to hear from the Palestinians who hosted us when we were there was, you're the problem. This is all your fault. If you as Americans would get your house in order, then everything here, the apartheid here, would eventually fall apart. And I think, how exciting is it that we're sending a Palestinian woman to Congress? I don't take for granted that her positions will be great every time. We're going to need to show up on her doorstep. We're going to need to follow up with her. We're going to need to hold her accountable. But she's going to go there, and she's going to be a Muslim woman in Congress. The other person, many of you are also familiar with, is Ilhan Omar from Minnesota. She came to the United States as a refugee. If you haven't seen her, she did an interview on Stephen Colbert maybe 2 years ago, and she labels herself Donald Trump's worst nightmare. And she is. I mean, she comes to the United States as a refugee from a country that can no longer send people to the United States, and she works really, really, really hard. She also is really blessed to land in the right place and make the right connections. And she serves in the state legislature, and now she'll be going on to Congress come January. And she's an African Muslim woman who wears a headscarf. And so you see not only the diversity of the America that we want to build between these two women, you see the diversity of Muslim women. One who wears a headscarf, one who doesn't. Immigrants recent, immigrants long term, both from a community organizing background. And so I'm really excited about the resistance movement that has developed in the last 2 years. I'm excited that we can say white supremacy in polite company and not be offensive. That we can talk about our president as a fascist in chief, that we're talking about things like slavery and genocide openly, and that we're not just talking about these things, that we're actually in the process of instituting systems change.
Do you have a suggestion for how to best apply the UN Universal Declaration of human rights to our policies that are dictated by transnational corporate elitists, including the U.S. government?
I get the UN question at least once a month, and I wish I could say that there were any teeth to any of the UN declarations. I think there was just another vote in one of the UN committees about something, and of course the two dissenting votes were America and apartheid Israel. It was about Cuba? Yes, right, and the two dissenting votes were about America and apartheid Israel, or were from America and apartheid Israel. Unfortunately, the UN does not have, at this time, power to move or correct the course that the United States is on. I would say that the most powerful tool that we all have is community mobilization. It's not even the courts. One of the hardest realizations for me around the Muslim ban was that the Supreme Court, like in Korematsu, like in Dred Scott, legalized racial and religious discrimination in their decision on the Muslim ban. The reason the Muslim ban is in effect is because the court let it be. And so the biggest opportunity that we have is all of you, taking to the streets, all of you putting your money on the line, all of you putting your bodies on the line, and all of you, all of us, electing better representatives who will do their job.
Maybe you wouldn't be there one day.
It seems like Muslim leaders are preferring Israel for its weapons and tactics of social control and are turning against Palestine. Is CARE getting any pressure to drop Palestine?
I'm really cautious of who I call a Muslim leader. I worry that our language is limited, and so leaders who are Muslim are called Muslim leaders, as though they're representative of the Muslim world or the Islamic faith. Obviously, a very common example of this is Saudi Arabia, not at all representative of the Islamic faith. Arguably, the antithesis of what Islam is supposed to be, as we see with their oppression of women, with their desecration of holy sites, and with their ongoing massacres in Yemen. And so when I think of people who are siding, who are disregarding the human rights crisis in Palestine, I don't think of them as my leaders. I think of them as greedy and corrupt, seeking power for themselves over for the benefit of the larger population. And so be cautious of that as you see countries in the Middle East and even Muslim activists in the United States take problematic positions supporting the state of Israel or opposing the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement. At CARE, we've been targeted by the federal government for 18, 19 years now, and one theory is that we are targeted in part because of our support of Palestinian rights. However, I wish we could do more on Palestinian rights. It is absolutely worth the risk. The challenge is that it's not within our mission scope, it's not within our lane, and so how many fights can we fight? The group that we partner with and support that I recommend all of you check out, actually two groups that I would say are so critical and need our support, are first and foremost American Muslims for Palestine. They're led by Dr. Hatem Bezian, who's based out of UC Berkeley, and they are manifesting what I talked about. They're spending their money right here in the United States to change policy. To say that we can't just send food to Gaza, we need to actually lift the blockade. And the way we lift the blockade is by supporting more and more members of Congress to be courageous, right? And so they'll do lobby days and campus education efforts. So check them out. And then of course the other group is Jewish Voice for Peace, right? The group that has been leading the way in saying Israel is not representative of Jews in the same way that Saudi Arabia is not representative of Muslims. And that Jews together need to and will speak out against Israeli fascist, racist, white supremacist policies. And so check out both of those organizations. I would say that rather than me doing more at CARE in support of Palestine, it's making sense and where I'm putting my energies and supporting those two organizations because that's their specialization and there's more than enough work to go around.
So question about your talk tonight, and that with your permission, this is being recorded and this will be posted on EPI's website along with the questions. So Google Ecumenical Peace Institute, you'll find the website, and this will probably be on there within a few days or a week or, okay, great.
Whatever you sign up for.
And then what would you like to share with us about your trip to Palestine?
So I wanted to go to Palestine for a really long time, but I have very mixed feelings about it. How dare I go if Palestinians can't go? Who am I to be so privileged that I could go into stolen land and act as though nothing was wrong? I was invited though by a Palestinian, which is why I accepted the invitation to say it needs to come from someone who actually has the ability or authority to invite me. I went with an interfaith group called Eyewitness Palestine, and I strongly recommend them if you're looking for a way to go or a group to go with. And we went on an interfaith delegation. And I'll tell you that from the minute we landed, I mean, I was willing to take my clothes off to get in. I understood. I actually sat with some Palestinian friends the day before I flew there, and they talked about the trauma that their families had of being forced out of their villages, of not being able to visit, and when they could finally visit, the humiliation that they endured. We had the opportunity, well, we landed. We went in through Tel Aviv, again, with the permission of Palestinians, because I was always told that was something I wasn't supposed to do. And we were held for 8.5 hours. And in our group of about 22, two people were deported. 18 were released, and then with the last two of us, I was like, they're gonna send us home. They're not letting us in today. And then they let us in. And I remember that there was a lot of fear and anxiety in the group even after that happened. But what I kept thinking to myself is that this is just a fraction of what Palestinians experience. This is just a fraction of what asylum seekers coming to the U.S. experience. And so there was a part of me that needed to live that, to say, okay, like, this is, I can't walk a mile in the shoes of a Palestinian. I would never dare try. But the closest I could get to it was to go through that, to see the people in the waiting room crying as they were being yelled at, to wonder what they would ask me next, to be prepared to endure a strip search because of the color of my skin, because of the religion that I practice. We were there for 8 days. We stayed mostly in East Jerusalem, but we had the opportunity to go to Bethlehem and the West Bank and other places. And we were at Masjid al-Aqsa on Friday afternoon one day, when after prayers, we're praying our voluntary prayers, so we're sort of not in congregation anymore, but we're still praying, and I heard bang, bang, bang. I said, what is that? Praying. And nobody around me moved, and it continued. And I thought, it's gunshots. It's got to be gunshots. But no one is moving. And eventually, we started to get text messages from the men in our group who were on the other side of the compound, and they said, stay in the building. People just hung out. It was normal for them to hear gunshots after prayer in the mosque compound. And what had happened was that Israeli soldiers had stormed the compound to help some settlers pass through. And they did it specifically when they knew that thousands of people would be exiting prayers. And they threw tear gas into the crowd, and they forced everyone out of the mosque because they said that, you know, it was volatile. It's like, well, yeah, you came in guns a-blazing right after prayer into a crowd of thousands. Of course it's volatile. Some of the Palestinian protesters threw fireworks back at the soldiers. And I remember asking someone, how do they have fireworks with them? And they said they're so used to being attacked at prayer that they carry them for self-defense. But what struck us was that the kids kept playing. And afterwards, we all had kanafa, like nothing had happened. And someone in the group was, you know, upset by this. They said, like, how is it that it's so normal? And the Palestinians who were with us said that normalcy, that existence with dignity, is itself a form of resistance. And so what I saw there was a really proud people who are holding on to their land. who are staying in refugee camps for 50, 60 years. We visited the camps of Ida and Dehesha, and these are the most tear-gassed parts of the world, where you put up bars on your windows and then you cross the bars so that the tear gas doesn't break into the house window. And the kids would come up to us and they'd be like, "Hi, what's your name?" And they're like barely learning English. And I thought, I'm complicit in this. That every time I pay my tax dollars, I choose my freedom over theirs. But the reality is I'm afraid to go to jail. And so I pay my taxes. But every time I do it, I'm facilitating apartheid there. Which is like, for me, opened up this conversation of what do I do then to recompense? What do I do then to say, I'm guilty, I carry that weight, but I'll do something else? How do I make up for my complicity in this? It's a beautiful place with beautiful people and an incredible story. If you haven't had a chance to visit, go with the invitation of a Palestinian. Stay in Palestinian-owned properties. See firsthand what's going on. I thought I was committed to Palestine until I went and I was like, okay, this is my cause. There's something about seeing it firsthand, about seeing the apartheid and the erasure of their culture, to see the guards with guns yelling at people, to be on a bus when they come on to check your passports and they walk past you with an AK-47. That changes the hearts and minds even of people who are already committed to the Palestinian.
Thank you so much. So this concludes our session. We're going to ask Rashid to come up and close us out.